This is a public lecture given in Auckland on August the 7th, 1979, by Mr. Geoffrey Hodgson. The lecture is entitled The Religion of Islam. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Geoffrey Hodgson.
And friends, under that second object, to encourage the study of comparative religion, philosophy and science, we are to study together this evening the religion of Islam. Interesting in many ways, one of the leaders is playing a big part in Iran and other parts of the Persian district, and also, by the by, many Mohammedans will in this period have retired at the start of what is called Ramadan, the Muslim month of fasting and prayers. And so Ramadan is, yes, it's greatly revered by the Muslims because they believe that it was in this month that God appointed their teacher, Muhammad, as his prophet, and revealed the Muslim holy book, which, as you know, is called the Quran. The word Mohammedan, which is the usual name for the religion, is an institution founded by the great Muhammad. Ramadan is generally the ninth month of the year, and at this time, from dawn to sunset, there is strict fasting and prayer. And as one respectfully studies the religion of Muslim, or Mohammedism, or, as it's also called, by the by, Islam, the youngest of all the great world religions, it is found to be in many ways the simplest and most explicit of world religions, for it venerates only a single, all-powerful deity. Its founder, as you of course know, Muhammad, was neither savior nor messiah, but one through whom, it is claimed, God chose to speak. The faith of Islam is unclouded by subtle arguments. No, there aren't any. It concerns itself as much with man's behavior in this world as with his fate in the hereafter. Unlike those religions which evolved slowly from obscure and legendary origins, Islam came into being in the full light of history, and yes, it spread then with hurricane speed. Islam is the religion of self-surrender, the meaning of Islam, the religion of self-surrender to God, which alone can bring peace to the world and peace to the soul of man. So Islam is a religion of surrender. Surrender to God, which alone can bring, they say, peace to the world and peace to the heart of man. It teaches that all the universe, which we can see, by the by, and the unseen universe, was brought into being at a word by the one and only God, whose nature is perfect goodness, absolute justice, and almighty power. Devotion to God, his maker, kindness, and justice to all his fellow creatures, prayer and service going hand in hand. This is the path which Islam leads to peace and joy forever. A wonderful, as you can see, an almost simple philosophy. Let me read what I should have more fully quoted. Devotion to God, his maker, kindness and justice to all his fellow creatures, prayer and service, going hand in hand. This is the path of Islam that leads to peace and joy, they say, ineffable. And another bulwark, shall I say, of Islam's strength is its assurance that the utterances of Muhammad, which we look at directly, that the utterances of Muhammad, as preserved in the Bible of Mohammedanism, the Quran, and other less sacred writings, these represent the final and absolute expression of the will of God. To the Muslim, the Quran, yes. Yes, to the Muslims, the Quran and other teachings represent and supersede all previous revelations. So they also accept and find that the Quran confirms the truths of the Old and New Testament. But in Muslim eyes, the Word of God was incompletely expressed in the earlier scriptures, yes, and only fulfilled in the Quran. And in the same way, one finds, Islam reveres the biblical prophets, from Abraham to our Lord Christ, contending only that Muhammad was the last and the greatest, the seal, as they put it, the seal of the prophets. Who then was Muhammad? Wonderful life story. Well, Muhammad, the messenger of God, came into the world in the year 570 AD in Mecca. He was born into the Quraysh clan. He was orphaned of his father before his birth, and he survived his mother by but a few years. And he grew up in his grandfather's house. All descriptions tell us that he was a quiet, silent boy, loving and gentle, patient, beloved by all, somewhat a strange blossom in that stern Arab countryside. In his early manhood, Muhammad traveled over the country outwardly as a trader. But at the age of 24, his kinswoman, Khadija, his elder trustworthy, his great friend, Khadija, was so trustworthy and looked up to him so, even as a boy, that she married him. And they, the young man and the older woman, lived in a marriage which is so perfect that it remains today as one of the ideals of, 50 years of married life. And then Muhammad himself died in 632 AD at the age of 63. And then, coming more closely to the religion, as one studies more closely the prophet's life and mission, one learns that inwardly, for much of his life, he was in strife. Throughout 15 years, storms of anguish, it is reported, drove him into the desert alone, where he would stay month after month. He flew, apparently, into the silence of the muddy wastes, lay stretched out on the ground in prayer, and took refuge eventually in a lonely cave. Bitter doubts assailed him and revealed wild questions going on in his own soul. And then, on a very dramatic occasion, he heard a voice which said, "In the name of the Lord, cry." "But what am I to cry? Why should I cry?" he thought to himself, for he was almost illiterate, untrained, doubting, despairing. He wondered whether it was not his own pride, his own conceit, his ambition that sent him this impossible message, "Cry." For 15 years, these times of agony assailed him, rent him, tortured him. And then at last came a night of nights. As he lay, as I've been describing, as he lay on the ground in his agony, a light shone in the darkness. And he looked up and the angel of the Lord was there, saying to him, "Rise, thou art the prophet of God. Go forth and cry in the name of thy Lord." Again, apparently, Muhammad asked, "What shall I cry?" Then the angel, he said, according to the tradition, the angel carried him away in spirit and told him, yes, great truth, carried him away in spirit and told him of the unity of God and the mystery and ministry of the angels in the building of the world and in the making of man, thereby revealing to him the work he was to do, his mission as a prophet of God. And then forth he went, rushed home, fell on the ground, dazed and angry. And he cried out to his wife, "What shall I do? Who am I? What am I?" And softly and steadfastly answered his faithful wife. She said, evidently, "Nay, thou art true and faithful. Thy word is never broken. Men know thy character. God does not deceive the faithful. Follow the voice," she said to him. "Obey the call." Well, the words of his wife, Khadija, the first disciple, gave the necessary touch to a human heart that was faltering before the greatness of the apparent mission. And thereafter, Muhammad stood up. He was no longer merely Muhammad alone, but the prophet of God, the man of whom it was prophesied that he would turn the lawless Arabia into a settled state, a mighty power, the man whose followers would relight the torch of science that fell from the palsied hands, yes, much earlier, of Greece and Rome. The result We mustn't spend too much time on it. But the result was remarkable. For within a few years of Muhammad's death in 632 A.D., Islam had overwhelmed the entire Middle East. And within another century, its dominions extended from Gibraltar to the Himalayas. And today, its adherents are very great in number. The latest figures I can get are 300 million strong. And these adherents of Islam, they encompass nearly one-seventh of the total population of the globe. All this from a man who lay in the cave, not knowing what to do with his life. How was it then that Islam became such a great success, and so rapidly? Well, as far as one can tell from one's studies, the reason for Islam's initial success lie interwoven in the web of history, in the chaos of the Mediterranean world, and in the zeal and the skill of the Arab armies. But that's all over, of course, now. But the continued strength and durability of Islam and the nature of its appeal, simple, lucid, and affirmative, has preserved the unity of Islam throughout some 1300 years. Isn't that interesting? I checked that. The nature of the appeal of Islam, and this is true, I found, is that its doctrine is simple, lucid, and affirmative. And this has preserved the unity of Islam throughout 1300 years. For as you study Islam, you find that it's really much more than a formal religion. It's an all-pervasive way of life, guiding thought, guiding action, to a degree without parallel in the Western world. And a key to its power of Islam would seem to lie in the word Islam. What does that word mean? It means submission or surrender, and implies submission to the will of God. Surrender to the will of God. The central message and thought of Islam. What then was the more special message of Muhammad to mankind? Well, he didn't leave a priestly religion. Islam doesn't believe in any mediators, or in any mediation between man and his maker, who, as the Quran says, man's maker — this is the most interesting affirmation, by the by — man's maker knew him before he was born and is closer to him than his jugular vein. Interesting, almost amusing, but very wonderful way of showing intimacy. So, I may repeat that. Man's maker knew him before he was born and is closer to him than his jugular vein. And then how is that maker described in Islam? Well, let me offer some results of study. He is the one God, the God on whom all depend. Most surely is your God but one, Lord of the heavens, Lord of the earth, and of all that is between, and Lord of the risings of the sun. God is also referred to as light. God is the light of the heavens and the earth. His light is like a lamp encased in glass. The glass as if it were a shining star. This is all quotations from the Quran, by the by. His light, now repeat it, his light is like a lamp encased in glass. The glass as if it were a shining star. It is lit from a blessed tree, an olive tree, neither eastern nor western, whose oil glows even when fire has not touched it. Light upon light, God guides whom he will to his light. And even when God speaks to man in metaphor, God knows everything. He is always known as light. As I've just said, the very term Islam denotes surrendering, of committing oneself to the will of God. Muslim means believer in the Arabic language. In addition to the Quran, Muhammad's son-in-law took up the great work. His name was Ali, and he took up the Prophet's teaching and led young men to study and to master science, above all, giving of science, I find from one of his statements, this definition. Here's what he says. Enlightenment of the heart is its essence. Now this is his definition of science. Ali, the son-in-law of Muhammad. Enlightenment of the heart is the essence of science. Truth, its principal object. Inspiration, its guide. Reason, its acceptor. God, its inspirer. And the words of man, its utterer. Wonderful, isn't it? Now repeat it. Enlightenment of the heart is its essence of science. He's talking about science. Enlightenment of the heart is its science, is its essence. Truth, its principal object. Inspiration, its guide. Reason, its acceptor. God, its inspirer. And the words of man, its utterer. And indeed, in philosophy, Muslims delved into the very being of the Supreme. They declared the existence of the one absolute, and the relation of the many to the one. And they proclaim and still proclaim the unity of the human spirit with the divine. And in a way, this forms part of Islam. But they also had some other philosophic ideas, though they're not very clearly pronounced. I've discovered, for example, that reincarnation was taught in those early days. The Holy Quran says, do not speak of those who are slain in Allah's way as dead. They are alive, but you do not know. How do you deny Allah? You were dead and he gave you life. Again he will cause you to die, and again will he bring you to life. Then shall you be brought back to him. Then also one finds references to the law of cause and effect, or karma. Here are the words, for instance. Whatever affliction befalls you, it is on account of what your hands have wrought. That's a good way of putting karma, isn't it? Whatever affliction befalls you, it's on account of what your hands have wrought. And again, whatever misfortune befalls you, O men, it is from yourself. And then underlying under all that is the concept, the affirmation of the unity of God and man. God says, we indeed created men, and we know what his soul whispers within him, and we are nearer to him than the jugular vein. Very mystic, beautifully mystic, you see, the divine presence within. Put in a different way, but a wonderful way. Now, yes, time permits me to turn to the more mystic aspect of Islam, which I just referred. And this has a name too. It's called Sufi. The word actually, Sufi, means in Arabic, means wool. Some think, referring to the substance of the garment of the mystics of those days. They wore clothes of wool, apparently. But Madame Blavatsky derives the word Sufi from the Greek root, Sophia, S-O-P-H-I-A, meaning wisdom. Sufism is also a wonderful study. It's described as the religious philosophy of Islam. And the Islamic mystics or Sufis speak of themselves in this way. They call themselves, the Sufis, the followers of the real. Wonderful name, too. The followers of the real. Sufism is also described as that mode of the religious life in which the emphasis is placed not on the performance of external ritual, but on the activities of the inner self. In other words, Sufism signifies Islamic mysticism, all depending upon one's inner self and its expression in the conduct of life. There are many objects stated, I found. I share one or two with you in order that we may know more of our subject. Here is one of the objects of the Sufi movement, which was formed within the general Mohammedan religion, by the groups of people who sought inner realization, the inner life. And the objects are stated to be, one, to realize and spread the knowledge of unity, the religion of love and wisdom, so that the bias of faith and the beliefs may itself fall away, so that the human heart may overflow with love, and all hatred caused by distinctions and differences may be rooted out. Lovely way of thinking, surely. The human heart may overflow with love, and all hatred caused by distinctions and differences may be rooted out. Someday we hope that will be universal. How far from it are we today, as our news unhappily revealed. What other objects were there? Well, to discover the light and power latent in man, the secret of all religion, the power of mysticism, and the essence of philosophy, without interfering with customs or beliefs. To discover the light and the power latent in man. And the third object, to help to bring the world's two opposite poles, east and west, closer together by the interchange of thought and ideals, so that the universal brotherhood may form of itself, and man may see with man beyond the narrow national and racial boundaries, the universal brotherhood of man. And then there came to enrich the teachings of Sufism, those of Ali and his disciples, and under them there blossomed the wonderful mysticism of the Sufis. If you study it, you find it's based upon certain sentences which presumably must be meditated upon. May I repeat two or three of them to you? It really takes us close to the heart of Sufism. As a mystic form of religion, in which by contemplation of the divine, the interior illumination is attained. Here then are some of the words, sentences, on which they meditated. All is from God. The universe is his mirror. All beauty is from him. All love from him. Here's a beautiful account of that mystical belief. Of deity they affirm, thou art absolute being. All else is but a phantasm, for in thy universe all beings are one. Thy world-captivating beauty, in order to display its perfection, appears in thousands of mirrors, but it is one. Although thy beauty accompanies all the beautiful, in truth, the unique and incomparable heart and flavor is forever one, meaning, of course, the one alone. Very close to yoga or philosophy, isn't it? Almost the same, expressed in their own special and very beautiful language. In truth, the unique and incomparable heart of God. The unique and incomparable heart and flavor is forever one. One of the great Sufi poets that Islam produced wrote a marvelous book called Mesnavi. And therein we find well-known philosophical ideas. Now read a line or two. He wrote, Jalaluddin Rumi, I died from the mineral and became a plant. I died from the plant and reappeared in an animal. I died from the animal and became a man. Well, there is the doctrine of evolution as it is presented in many world faced. Wherefore then should I fear? When did I grow less by dying? Next time I shall die from the man, that I may grow the wings of the angel. For the angel too must I seek advance. All things shall perish, save his faith. Capital initials. All things shall perish, save his faith. Once more, he wrote, I shall wing my way above the angels. I shall become that which entereth not the imagination. Then let me become naught, naught. For the harp string crieth unto me, verily unto him shall we return. Purest mysticism, deepest yoga insight, one might presume to say. And then again I found, to my surprise rather, in my earlier studies of this subject, that the Christian idea of the communion of saints and the far more ancient Indian, Buddhist and theosophical concept of a brotherhood of saints does exist in Sufis. They put it differently, of course, but allow me to present it to you. These saints of the Sufis, not quite the same as the brotherhood of the adepts, but let me use their very words. These saints in Islam form a sort of hidden or occult hierarchy upon whom depends the order of the world, and the supreme head of the hierarchy is the most eminent Sufi of his time. The hierarchy operates in the invisible world, as does its head. Below the head are five grades. From above downwards, there are three overseers, four supports, seven pious, 40 substitutes, 300 good. They do not all know one another and act only by mutual consent. For the student of theosophy, of course, such sayings, not easily comprehensible, remind one very definitely of the concept of the existence on earth of a great hierarchy of perfected men and women who decide to remain in touch with the planet and all upon it. The hierarchy of the adepts of this globe, in its turn, of course, having its degrees of development, office, power, and yes, its supreme head, the head of the hierarchy on earth. That you find in Indian and Buddhist doctrine and within the teachings of Theosophia. Somewhat different here, but reminding us, the four supports, goes on, pass round the whole world every night. That means four groups of great saints. In theosophy would probably say adepts. They call them supports of the world. The four supports pass round the whole world every night. Should they overlook any part, trouble will appear there. They at once inform the head, who directs his blessing to that place. Very, very much similar to the great concept of the brotherhood of the adept. And in closing, may I just say that the aim which the Sufis set before them is stated somewhat like this: to free the soul from the tyrannical yoke of the passion, to deliver it and its wrong, to deliver it from its wrong inclination and evil instinct, in order that in the purified heart there should only remain room for God and for the invocation of His holy name. Beautiful, isn't it? May I repeat it? May we think of it together? The aim which the Sufis set before them is as follows: to free the soul from the tyrannical yoke of the passion, to deliver it from its wrong inclinations and evil instincts, in order that in the purified heart there should only remain room for God and for the invocation of His holy name. Yeah, my friends, with these historical, religious, and philosophic and mystic contributions of Islam, very much condensed, leaving out so much. But there I must close my presentation of Islam, should I say exoteric and very esoteric. I don't know whether there are any members here. If so, I would apologize for mistranslation, misquotation, and close with their great affirmation, which are uttered from the minaret at certain times, day by day, and frequently. I'll try my best. La ilaha illa Allah. There is no God but Allah. Try again. La ilaha illa Allah. There is no God but Allah. In the more personal one, between us all, I Salaam Alaikum. A very lovely greeting you always get when you're with them. As Salaam Alaikum. Meaning, peace be on you. So may I close for us all. As Salaam Alaikum. Thank you.
Mr. Hodgson, now answers some written questions sent up to him from his audience.
Yes, his words, he spoke. I don't think he was a writer. Now, he stated, I noticed, to be illiterate. So his words were heard by his disciples who wrote the Quran. Yes. I'll check that in a moment. Where does the revelation of Angel Gabriel and fire of cloth come in only one God concept? Well, like you and I, we're only one body, but we've got arms and different parts of the body, but it's one body. Similarly, if we could once have our awareness centered in the divine heart and being of the Lord of the universe, we would see that although that is manifest in the innumerable ways and beings it is, as the Sufis say, but one God. Could it be, perhaps, that, yes, could it be one blood, you see, is pulsing through all the many, many parts of one's body, which are performing so very many different functions, yes, but it's one blood, which is flowing throughout all. I understand your thought, but meditation will take one from the over-accentuation of separated objects, beings and creatures and fellow human beings into a realization which can't really be explained in words, but is a realization in consciousness, which Muhammad obviously had. God is one, and he's nearer to you than the jugular vein. One God. Many mystical, you know, and very esoteric teachings, for their realization, they depend upon the transcendence of the separative mind into the level of abstract awareness, where time is transcended, place is transcended, and separate beings are all realized, less and not indeed as separate, but manifestations of one. That, I can say that then, because I've read that I'm not in this state of consciousness, but if one arises through Sufi meditation, through yoga, through prayer, up to the levels beyond the separated argumentative mind, into intuitive awareness, then you don't have to ask any more questions, friend. You know one life throughout all, wherever manifest, one life, your own, all life. So you cannot always, this is what many, many find out, you cannot correctly, always, and demonstratively state the truth of oneness at the level of the concrete mind. For the concrete mind inevitably accentuates its usefulness, the differences between the manifestations of life. You and I are all different. We can see each other, and there we are. All human beings, it's true, but different. Yes, but a touch, a touch only of the inner intuitive awareness at once released reveals life in all is one life. And that the Sufis accentuated. It really only was what you might call Sufism, you might say. It's the yoga of Islam. More? Another question? How does one know the will of God from our thoughts, etc.? Same answer, friend. We must, by the practice of meditation, regularly carried out until it succeeds, despite continuing failure, the regular daily meditation upon the one life in all, affirming and eventually realizing, I am that life, that am I. I've written a little booklet to guide us, taken not from my wisdom but from these teachings, in which I will repeat to you a few lines. Here is the process of meditation beyond the restrictions, useful restrictions, remember, of the concrete mentality, which accentuates always separateness. Now then, something like this. The meditating aspirant seated quietly in a comfortable position, body relaxed, spine straight, really aspiring, not just playing, really aspiring, affirmed. I am not the physical, emotional, mental body. I am the spiritual self. I am the divine self, immortal, indestructible, eternal, radiant with spiritual light. Then the great affirmation, I am that eternal self of life. That am I. And if one will go on practicing that gradually, the pathway through meditation. A word of counsel. Always withdraw from the yogic and elevated state gradually, never with a rush. Bring the center of awareness back into the mind, now intuitive, illumined, back into the emotional body and nature, shining with brilliant light, and into the body, empowered by spiritual will. You sit quietly. Let all of that quietly find its place into the mind and the heart. Thereby revealing that, in spite of living day by day in the clearly undeniable presence of differences, never mind. The light and the life of the universe are one. Furthermore, I am that one. That am I. Now, if anyone will do that regularly, that oneness will become known. Well, as I understand it, to return to our subject, that in part was the teaching of the Sufi sect of the religion of Islam.
And that poem concludes the talk by Mr. Geoffrey Hodgson, which was recorded in Auckland on the 7th of August 1979, and the subject again was the religion of Islam.